The longer this rebrand goes, the more I continue to be surprised. Years ago, I reached out to a man that was part of my original 25. He's perhaps the most well-known name in the entire Earhart case. Some people also consider him to be a bit of a polarizing figure. When I reached out, I was a nobody. I had no contacts, no experience, except from my own handful of years in pre-research, and I had no expectations about receiving a response. To my surprise, he reached right back out, and we began a dialogue. We've had our differences over the years, but to his credit, and my surprise, he's now returned to the show after a 6-year hiatus to discuss the case for the Castaway Hypothesis and his new book that's being discussed as his swan song to the Amelia Earhart story. This is a sentence I thought I'd never utter on this show again. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From Tiger HQ in Oxford, Pennsylvania, this is Rick Gillespie. And we're live. Rick, hell hasn't frozen over. Welcome back to the show. It's been a long time. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
No, it's great to be here with you, Chris. It really is.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I consider you very knowledgeable on this, and it's only right. I won't waste any time. About 9 months ago, as Deep Sea Vision's sonar image was all over the world, you did an interview with Fox News, and you knew then, among other folks that were pointing it out, that the widely circulated image wasn't an Electra 10E. We now know, just in the past few days, that it is in fact not an Electra. I know where I want to go next. Where do you think we go from here?
Well, first, I would like to thank Tony Romeo, because I'm sure without intending to, what he did and the way the media reacted to it couldn't have been better for me and for Tiger. You know, he put this out there and the media, of course, went crazy. Wall Street Journal front page. And I just said, oh my God, here we go. Then, of course, Fox comes along. I have to hand it to them. They were fair to me. That was a good interview. Now, the comments were brutal, just vicious.
Yeah. But yeah.
I've been doing this for a long time. You know, my skin is very thick on this. Mm-hmm. And of course, I knew I was right. Mm. So what Tony did was put the Earhart name and the Earhart mystery right back up there in front of everybody for the months before my book was published.
Mm-hmm.
I swear to God, he is not on our payroll. I really do thank him for that. And he's been very gracious in admitting that, you know, hey, Sam, he's disappointed. And I've been there. You know, I've done searches that didn't turn up what I hoped they would. It's tough.
That's a good point. Credit to Tony Romeo. He will be back on the show soon. We will ask him where they go from here, what they're doing next. I think that's very important to the case. 6 years ago, you last appeared on this show and we discussed the post-loss radio signals that make up part of Tiger's collection of evidence for Castaway. You have a brand new book, One More Good Flight, The Amelia Earhart Tragedy. We'll get into as much as we can here tonight. Let's start with the book. I read it. I enjoyed it. Told you off air. Very well done. That's no surprise. Let's start with the title, One More Good Flight, The Amelia Earhart Tragedy. I enjoy a good Easter egg. And her statement that you mentioned to C.B. Allen about having one more good flight left in her is a good one. And I also happen to agree that this whole thing has been a tragedy. I know a lot goes into coming up with a title. Tell me why this title felt right for this particular book in this time frame.
Well, as you noted, I've been doing this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been writing for a long time. And I will say in all humility that many of our members and followers follow us because of my writing. And I knew that it would be really important to get the right title for this book.
Hmm.
In looking through all we learned about Earhart and the many things she said, it just struck me as so ironic that she should say that.
Yeah.
And I said, all right, if we do the title that quotes her, One More Good Flight, which is a very positive thing to say, and then include a subtitle, The Amelia Earhart Tragedy, that sets up a tension.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute, a One More Good Flight tragedy? What's this about? You know, and I'm delighted with it. I had nothing to do with the cover design. I'm delighted with the cover design.
Yeah,
the,
it's a good cover.
the Naval Institute Press chose to do a cover that kind of mirrors the cover of my first book, Finding Amelia, the True Story of the Earhart Tragedy. So there's continuity there.
Yeah.
And they've been wonderful to work with. They're a great publisher and, of course, superb credibility. They're not big. And most of the books that they publish are not like this one. I mean, most of their books are by retired naval officers writing about their favorite battleship. You know?
Yeah.
And that's great. And they've got a great audience and they do wonderful work. They kind of took this on. We'll see where it goes. Let me just give your listeners a quick overview of what the book itself is like.
Sure.
You've done, what, 105 episodes?
Something like that.
You've talked to many people with many theories who've written many books. This book is a completely different animal.
Mm.
It's the only book about the Earhart disappearance that meets academic standards for thoroughness and accuracy. And of course, it's the product of Tiger's 34-year investigation, the Earhart Project. It's 400 pages. It's a long book. 45 chapters, 37 photographs, 13 maps, 1,267 citations.
That's the rub right there.
That's the rub. My response to any criticism of this book is show me where I'm wrong, because I'm showing you where I got the information. And these are all mostly primary sources, in some cases secondary sources that are well cited. It's been endorsed by university professors, aviation experts. The most common phrases we're getting in reviews are, this is the definitive work on the Earhart disappearance.
Yeah.
And it's irrefutable and it's well written and a fascinating experience. I mean, you can have the truth, you can have the facts, but if nobody reads it, nobody knows it. This had to be a doctoral dissertation that reads like a novel that you can't put down.
Yeah, that's a tough area to strike.
That's proving to be exactly what it is. We're consistently in the top 50 aviation history books on Amazon. We were 25 today. Over 3,000 hardcover copies have been sold in the last 45 days since it was released. We don't have numbers yet on the ebook or the audio versions.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's going crazy. You had commented to me offline that you thought the book was well organized.
Yeah.
One of the things about that that was suggested by the editor that we worked with on it, she thought, this is such a big book that covers so much territory, you need to break it up a little bit. Mm. And so the book is divided into three chronological sections. The first section, we call it The Real Amelia Earhart,
yeah,
and it covers from 1928 to 1937, the takeoff from Ley, from her friendship flight across the Atlantic as a passenger to the departure of her final flight.
Yeah.
That whole first section provides the background, the context for what happened then. Then the second section is 1937, the final flight, the failed search, and Earhart's true fate. Mm. This is what really happened, hour by hour, documented in primary sources. And then the final section we call Changing Mystery to History, which is kind of Tiger's slogan. And that covers the aftermath of the failed search, what happened then, how Japanese capture came about, and then finally, how we solved the mystery. It's Tiger's story. And I think there's like three chapters that cover Tiger's story, which can only skim the surface.
Sure.
Again, the sources are all there. Okay, so that's what the book is like. It sells on Amazon for $31.64 for hardcover, $29.99 for the Kindle, which is, you know, gosh, you might as well get unless you really like books, you might as well get the hardcover book. You've seen the book. It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
The audiobook, you join audiobooks and it's like $1.
Yeah.
So what the hell?
You know, you've been talking about, you just mentioned it earlier, this is a product of 34 years of Tiger's work. It kind of reads like a swan song. In fact, you know, the Fox News interview you did 9 months back, everything's in the book. I can imagine that for as long as you've been involved in this case, it might be attractive to just put your final thoughts down on paper and just, that's it. I'll just ask you straight out, and I think I know the answer. Are these your final thoughts on the case? Like, are you done with the case, do you think?
Well, you know, I kind of hoped we were. We reached a point where we said, okay, we've got this. We know what happened. We know how it happened. We know why it happened. And I've written it. It took 5 years, but it's written. We've made our case. Now I want to get back to the mystery that actually spawned Tiger in 1984.
Yeah, it's been a while.
The mystery of the disappearance of l'oiseau blanc, the white bird. So I thought, yeah, okay, swan song, here we are, boom, done. And then strange thing happened. I was contacted by a guy in England, university professor, who was writing a book about the dispersal of British colonial records after the empire broke down. Okay, so you've got all these countries that were once colonies, and now they're independent countries, and we have all these records. Where did they all go? Who's got them? How were they dispersed? And he was looking into that, and he saw that me and one other Tiger researchers, had copied documents. We had tracked down where they were of the Western Pacific High Commission. This was the British colonial administration in the South Pacific. And you read the book, you know the story. A huge thing. There was this whole incident that had been forgotten and dismissed as a rumor. It was actually true. Her bones were found on Gardner Island, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so we tracked down those records, which at that time, this was 1998, were stored at a place called Her Majesty's Central Communications Center in a place called Hanslope Park. It's 60 miles north of London. Well, this professor read that and he said, wait a minute, Her Majesty's Communications Center? I know that those archives are there. I also know that they're co-located in that center with MI6, the British secret. This is where MI6 does all their photo analysis stuff. Nobody gets into Hanslope Park. And so he contacted me and said, how in God's name did you guys get into Hanslope Park to get this information? And I had to tell him. I said, well, we were invited. We had queried them by telephone and letters and fax. This is in the days before email. We established our credibility, and they waived getting British security clearances and the whole thing. And we got in there, and we were in there for 4 days. Came away with 300 copies of records and documents that nobody had ever. So I'm replying to this guy. He says, well, I'd like to see the correspondence that led to you being invited in there. And so I started I started digitizing hundreds of pages of correspondence and stuff. And in doing that, I stumbled across kind of a throwaway comment that we had said. He says, oh, and there is this anecdote about after World War II, in the late 1950s, photographs were taken of airplane parts on the beach at Nicomororo. And I said, where the hell did that come from? Because in fact, if there are photographs of airplane parts on the beach, where are they? Because, you know, that would be huge if we could find them. And so I got digging back through our records and I realized where that came from. And it came from 1997 when we were marooned ourselves at a place called Funafuti in the nation of Tuvalu. We were stuck there because we got caught in what amounted to a South Pacific hurricane, had to run for sheltered water. We were stuck there for a while. There were former Nicomororo residents there who we interviewed. And this one woman, name was Tapania Teaki, told us that as a child, like a 6, 7, 8-year-old child, she used to play on the beach where there were airplane pieces washed up. And there out on the reef flat, there was a piece of a wing. I asked her what color it was, and she pointed to the corrugated roof on the house he was living in. It's this aluminum colored, you know. Jeez, you know. And shipwreck wreckage is rusty.
Yeah.
I thought, oh my God. Yeah. So, but then as almost like a throwaway comment as we were leaving, she said, oh yeah. And one day some white men came in a government ship to take pictures of those airplane parts, and we had to take them across the lagoon passage in a canoe. Oh, okay. Whoa. And I got thinking about this, and I said, well, hell, what government, what ship, who were these people? Where should we look for this photo? Because by now, I know that Tapania was credible. Because after we got home from that, she had told us about seeing airplane parts on the reef flat in this particular area. She marked a map. We went back and looked at aerial mapping photos taken in 1953. And sure enough, there's light-colored metal there that shouldn't be there. And then later, we found other accounts and ultimately found the photograph of the landing gear on the reef up where this stuff would have come from. So it all fit. So Tappany is credible. And here she's saying, oh, yeah, and by the way, these white men came and took pictures. Okay, here we go again.
Yeah.
And I'm now writing an article. I'm in the middle of it, writing an article for Tiger Tracks, our journal, explaining all this. And so we got to find out if these bobos still exist.
Yeah.
It raises so many questions. If, in fact, these people came and took pictures of photos, and if they took pictures of airplane parts, it was Earhart's airplane.
Yeah.
But if they knew that, why wasn't that a big deal?
Yeah.
Or were the parts too indistinct for them to identify as electric parts? They're just airplane parts, and maybe it was Earhart, but we don't know for sure. We need to dig into this. So, Chris, it never ends.
It never ends.
That's true of any historical investigation. There's no such thing to an end of an investigation. And I fully expect, as has happened before, we put this book out and we stir things up with it, mm-hmm. and people will come out with new information. I mean, it has happened so many times, stuff that nobody ever knew before. Oh, yeah, I have this letter. I have this photograph. So, yeah, to answer your question, no, it's not a swan song. No, you don't get away that easy.
I know that very well, all too well. In the preface of the book, you mentioned something that I thought was very interesting. You mentioned Ken Burns' quote about iconic historical figures often being, I think it's just smothered in mythology, right? Couldn't agree more. I think that's what's happening here, certainly. I think, again, I know the answer to this, but how big a role do you think the mythology factor has played in the events of July the 2nd and then everything that's happened since then?
Let me remind you of something that kind of explains that. I actually start the first chapter with it, and it's a quote from Pancho Barnes.
Yeah, that was my next point. Go for it.
Yeah. Pancho said in a book she wrote later, there were at that time dozens of more competent women pilots than Amelia, but because of her disappearance and all the publicity that surrounded her last flight, she achieved her great aim to be the most famous woman pilot. She will undoubtedly continue to hold this position, and I hope she does. Well, Pancho couldn't have imagined where this thing went.
Yeah.
You remember, what was it, 2 years ago? Somebody's mother had a leather helmet mm-hmm. that she decided was the same helmet Amelia had worn on a 1928 flight mm-hmm. and put up for auction. And what was that, hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was, actually, I think it topped $800,000 or some astronomical number for her. Yeah. I think something like that.
And it's the wrong helmet.
Yeah. Well,
those helmets, okay, this allegedly was found on the ground in the 1929 Cleveland Air Races. It's this leather helmet with a white trim on it. Nobody knows what helmet Amelia wore in that 1929 race, but we do know that Gladys O'Donnell wore a helmet just like that,
mm-hmm.
and they sold for $2 in 1929 and 27. It's just crazy. $15 million new museum, the Amelia Earhart Hangar Museum.
Yeah, it's a beautiful museum. Been there.
Statue in the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah.
Only aviator with a statue in the U.S. Capitol, one of only 12 women.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Just over the top, and yet a whole lot of what everybody thinks they know about Amelia Earhart is not true.
Mm.
The story of how she did become as famous as she did, how she got started to become this icon after she was dead, is really a fascinating story, and you've seen it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There really was a government cover-up.
Yeah, there was.
But it wasn't the cover-up everybody thinks it was. I wrote this book, and with the stuff that we learned, I said, you know, I want everybody about every two pages to stop and say, whoa, I didn't know. As you can imagine, I feel pretty gratified about having gotten this thing out there, and it's so well-received. We'll see if it makes a paradigm shift. My good friend, Dr. Richard Jantz, forensic anthropologist, University of Tennessee, he wrote to me. He says, well, we'll probably never convince the deniers, but anyone capable of processing evidence should consider the matter closed. Mm. So that's his take on it. And that's the way I feel about it, too. And I have no control about it. People are going to believe what they want to believe.
Yeah. Well,
so what questions do you have, Chris?
Well, let's shift to some of the evidence. I mean, it's been 6 years since you've been on the show. Let's clear up some misinformation here tonight. We've talked a lot about the evidence in your pair of appearances on the show. Let's start with 22V1. There's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not it's from an Electra or something else entirely. In, I think it was September of 23, you were quoted as saying that Jeff Glickman was working on it, but it was looking like 22V1 may have been from a World War II Douglas C-47. I want to ask you just what's the status on 22V1 as of tonight?
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So you read the book, and in the book, I take the position that 22V1 is in all probability from a World War II C-47, one that crashed on Sydney Island, now known as Monra, in 1943. I'm still waiting for Jeff's final report on 22V1. Jeff sent me a letter of opinion, and he said, okay, the how well that piece of metal matches the particular section on the C-47 wing is not really the issue. To have absolute certainty that that piece of metal is not the patch from the Electra, what we need is imagery that shows something on the patch that is not on the artifact, or vice versa. This cannot be this because
Right.
of, you got to have that.
Something unmistakable.
Something unmistakable. Just the fact that one piece of an airplane, rivet patterns and thickness and so forth, is just like another airplane. There are probably other examples of that. I don't know for sure, but I've taken the position in the book that, yeah, it's probably from the C-47. That's probably true. But I still want to see the damn imagery myself. It never ends. There is a hypothesis about how it got from Sydney Island to where we found it on Nikku. Okay, so it was salvaged from the wreck that happened in 43. And then after the war, we know that people from Sydney Island moved to Gardner and they could logically take this thing with them. It was a handy piece of metal. But 22V1 shows signs of having been underwater for a considerable period, shallow, warm water, because it's got coral growth on it. And the edges of it are smooth. And if you've ever handled airplane wreckage, you've got to be very careful. You cut yourself. You can't cut yourself on this thing. This thing scrubbed around on an abrasive surface for probably years and grew coral at it. How does that fit with the, yeah, we brought it over from Sydney? And I just, so there are things that bother me about it. But what I'm always try to guard against, as any investigator should, is confirmation bias. You're always looking for reasons that the thing you're investigating is the thing you want it to be. You're always looking for reasons to believe that. And you've got to be very careful not to be selective. But the same goes in the opposite. If you say, okay, so it's not that. Well, there can be negative confirmation bias too. You gotta have all the answers, the questions answered. Yeah, so that's where we are with 2 to be 1. Drives me nuts.
Another big one, and we'll talk about this next. I know John Cada did some research on the sextant that was previously thought to belong to Fred Noonan and may have come
That was
from the
another
USS
red herring.
original. Yeah, in 39. Is that something that Tiger is looking into still, or is the sextant, how
No,
did you guys strike it?
that seems to be pretty solid. That and it's the most bizarre coincidence you can imagine. But bizarre coincidences happen. How the heck it turned out that a guy from the Bushnell survey in 1939 happened to leave behind the box with the same kind of sextant that Noonan used as a backup sextant, very close to where Earhart died and her remains were found. How the heck does that happen? But it did, and you just have to accept that. It's okay. Crazy coincidences happen. And it was John Cada that did that. I didn't do that. He worked very hard at that in the National Archives and digging out those records.
Yeah, props to John Cada. He'll be on the show soon. We'll talk about it. We'll get into it in a little more detail. Let's talk about my favorite piece of evidence. When I ever do media of any kind and people ask me about Castaway in any way, shape, or form, and they say, hey, what sticks out to you the most? I always talk about the post-loss radio signals. I think the way they're explained, I think the way they're triangulated, and I think the way the math works out and the low tide, high tide works out, I think it's really hard to ignore. We won't go into too much of it. I'll link the original conversation in the show's notes for tonight. Where do we stand on the post-loss radio signals? Is that something you guys keep digging into, or have those basically kind of reached their end?
Well, they have reached their end, mostly because the genius that did the analytical work, Lieutenant Commander Bob Brandenburg, died.
Yeah.
We lost Bob a couple of years ago, but that man was just incredible. But fortunately, the work he did, he wrote it up in academic papers. It's there on the Tiger website. Anybody can access it. It's all right there. His study of the Pan-American Direction Finder bearings and the tidal work. And Bob and I worked on all that stuff for 12 years, looking for alternative explanations. How many credible signals were there? What were the alternatives? And then, of course, you go back, and it's funny because I was just listening to the audio book last couple of days because I hadn't heard it yet. I'm going through, and I've been listening to the whole bit about what Itasca and other radio operators were hearing. They thought they heard her, and then they were quite sure they heard her.
Yeah.
Then they heard a man's voice, and they said, "No, it's not her," because they didn't know Noonan was with her. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to the whole thing. There's a whole chapter about that. And that itself, it says, no, she was out there calling for help. And if you say even one of those signals was sent by Earhart, she didn't crash at sea. Crashed and sank. Crashed and sunk years ago.
Yeah.
It cannot have happened. You're right. You know, the post, the whole body of post-loss radio signals, not only what was heard by the professionals in the Pacific, but was heard by private citizens like Dana Randolph and Benny Klenk on harmonics, and Mrs. Crabb, and on, and how they're, what they heard matches. The whole thing, just the reviewers say it's irrefutable.
So. Yeah, it's a strong piece of evidence. I think what I'm sort of building to is we have a lot of young people in this audience that will be listening to this that are fascinated with the case, and they're new minds. They're fresh minds. They haven't really had a lot of experience or exposure to it. I ask this question a lot, but I don't think I've ever asked it of you in either appearance. At what point can you, as an investigator, completely dismiss a piece of evidence, especially when there's several possibilities or explanations for what any given piece can be? How do you know when it's out or when you have to say, hey, maybe not so fast?
Obviously, assessing evidence is the essence of investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do that? Evidence is a broad term.
Yeah.
There are different types of evidence. The best kind of evidence is archival documents, written accounts that were generated at the time. That's one of the main ways our investigation differed from everybody else's, because everybody else attacking the Earhart mystery made the assumption that the facts of the case could be found in the after-action reports by the Coast Guard and Navy and in Earhart's own writings about what she said happened.
Mm.
And we said, no, the original sources are the messages, the logbooks, the telegrams that were generated at the time. And we've got to find those. And there was one guy who did that for us. He's Dr. Randy Jacobson, who worked for the Office of Naval Research. He spent 6 years finding all this stuff in various archives. All these messages, all these letters that were generated at the time. And then he databased them chronologically, which is a real trick because they all happen in different time zones. And some of the time zones have changed since 1937.
Yeah.
But once we had Randy's database, we had a chronological account of what really happened day by day, hour by hour, in some case, in moment by moment. That's the kind of evidence that is as good as it gets. Now, even so, there are flaws in that. If you look closely, you can find them. For example, the Itasca radio log.
Yeah.
There, we said this, Earhart said that. You may be familiar with the Itasca operator log that she said, "We are circling but cannot hear you."
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at that original log, and thank God Leo Bellarts, the chief radio man, kept it and then gave it to the National Archives. We looked at that and we said, there's something funny here, because the word, first of all, circling doesn't make any sense. If you don't know where you are, you don't just circle. You look for what you're looking for. We looked at that and said, yep, circling isn't lined up with the rest of the typed line. There's a platen misalignment there. So you scan it, you go into Photoshop, you take out circling, and there's something under circling, and you can make it out, and it's drifting. Okay. So Galton, the radio operator, when he initially typed this out, heard it, he typed, "We are drifting but cannot hear you." And apparently, sometime later, moments or minutes, I don't know, said, "Nah, that doesn't make sense. Drifting but cannot hear you? Circling." Yeah, it's probably circling. And that's what he put in. And for 80 years, he, everybody, oh, she was circling.
Yeah.
She said she was listening but cannot hear you. I mean, come on. Drifting, circling, listening. Listening, same sounds, but what's going to make sense? We are listening but cannot hear you.
Yeah.
Okay. That is from an original source document, and that's the kind of thing you have to be on the lookout for. Okay, so to answer your question, yeah, top of the stack is archival written documents. Photographic evidence is great, but you've got to be very careful.
Yes.
You have to be able to date it accurately. Look at what happened to the History Channel with the picture of Earhart Noonan on the dock in Jello.
Yeah.
You know, it's a 1935 photograph. Come on. Our photographic evidence, and we really only have two important pieces of photographic evidence. One is the 1953 aerial mapping photo that shows light-colored metal on the reef at Gardner. The other one, of course, is the landing gear, the wreckage of the landing gear. We had to be so, I mean, when Jeff Glickman first called me and told me that it's not just a man-made object, we're looking at components of the main landing gear. I can see the strut, I can see the tire, I can see the worm gear, the fender. And I said, oh God, Jeff, that's too many eggs in one basket. We need a second opinion on this thing.
Yeah.
We had good connections at the State Department. Kurt Campbell, the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and the Pacific Islands, and said, if there's anything we can do to help you, let me know. And I said, yeah, I needed somebody who doesn't have a dog in the fight to look at this picture. He said, yeah, well, I got people that can do that. I much later found out who did it. These were people from something called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. That it's a branch of the CIA, and at that time, even the name of the agency was classified.
Yeah. Now,
we gave them the photograph. After 2 months, they called me in for briefing, and you know, there were three guys who didn't have last names, you know. And they said, well, we've looked at this, we've done our own research, and basically we see what your guy sees.
Mm.
Oh, man. Okay, you're going to give me a written report? No. Well, can I at least tell people? Which, no, you can't. I said, what's going on?
And that's got to be frustrating.
Well, yeah. Here I've got smoking gun evidence here, and I can't talk about it. And they said, well, we did this as a favor to Kurt, the Assistant Secretary of State. If the people we work for knew we were spending time on something like that, we'd catch all kinds of hell.
Mm.
Okay, great. Well, so I couldn't talk about it, but they had to report back to Kirk Campbell, and Kirk Campbell couldn't keep his mouth shut. And the next thing I know, I get called into the State Department and told, look, we think you've got this nailed, and we want to help you get back out there and find whatever there is to find. We know you've got an expedition planned for next year, which this was all happening in 2012. We want you to do it this year. Why? Well, we just do. We think it needs to happen this year. Well, the reason it needed to happen this year, I later found out, was that Hillary Clinton wanted to be involved in it and get credit for it. She was going to step down as Secretary of State, whether Obama got reelected or not. So it had to happen in 2012.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there with Kurt, and he says, yeah, we think we've got this nailed. My secretary is so excited about it, she wants to announce it herself. And I said, what do you mean, what secretary are you talking about? He says, oh, what I work for. And suddenly things got surreal. Oh, my God. You know,
and yeah,
on March 20th, 2012, I found myself on the dais in the Benjamin Franklin room of the U.S. State Department with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, Kurt Campbell, of course, the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Kiribati that owns the island, and Bob Ballard. And Kurt told me he was going to Ballard there. I said, oh, Kurt, no, not Ballard. He says, why? Why not Ballard? I said, if Bob gets involved in this thing and we find something, it'll be Bob who found it. Bob is the great finder of all things.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, but we've got to have him there because he's cover. And what do you mean? Well, if you get out there and you don't find anything, and anybody tries to say, well, you know, Gillespie just sold you a bill of goods, and Bob Ballard has gotten up there and said, no, this is the real deal, then we're cool. Mm-hmm. And that's what Bob did. Bless his heart. He got up there and said wonderful things about Tiger and me and how he wouldn't touch this thing with a 10-foot pole because he only looks for things that he knows are there. Of course, in 2019, he went back out there and tried himself.
Sure.
Tried to tell him, you're not going to find it. But
Yeah.
anyway,
What were your thoughts on that, on Expedition Amelia? First of all, I watched it when it came out. It's a gorgeous documentary. It showcases Nicky Mororo, I mean, better than you can. If you
very.
haven't seen it, for listeners, and we'll link it in the show notes, it's on Disney Plus. If you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor, go watch this documentary. It strikes a good balance between the legacy and the disappearance and what you guys are doing out at Nicky Mororo. Bob Ballard takes center stage in it. What are your thoughts on that documentary now, looking back on that? Obviously, you were primary in that. Do you regret that documentary at all? Do you?
No,
What were your thoughts?
it turned out exactly the way I thought it was going to.
Yeah.
We had already done our $2 million expedition to try to find wreckage of the airplane off the reef and couldn't find anything. We had, based on that, had gone back and decided that, well, it's pretty apparent what happened. If you spend 10 minutes on the edge of that reef, it is the most violent, dynamic places in the planet.
It looks like it.
And you've got this 5,000 ton British freighter, iron and steel, that is now scattered rusty debris.
Yeah, that's there now. It's still there as we
It's
speak.
still
Yes.
there. There's not much left now.
Yeah.
But you think, well, that's what's left of a 5,000 ton freighter. And we're talking about a 7,000 pound aluminum eggshell
Aluminum aircraft. Yeah.
going in that environment.
Yeah.
And then we've got all this, both photographic and anecdotal indications that the airplane broke up and was scattered, and some of it washed ashore, some of it got hung up on the reef. We got a picture of the landing gear wreckage. So after all these years, whatever is left is scattered, buried in coral, covered in underwater landslides. There's sadly nothing left to find. And
Yeah.
I had already decided that. And so I wasn't at all surprised when Ballard's expedition didn't come up with anything. And I wasn't surprised when National Geographic archaeological team on shore didn't find any bones. Because we had looked and looked and looked for
Yeah.
surviving bones at that site. And we'd had the dogs in there before. And the dogs confirmed, yeah, somebody died here,
Right.
but there's no bones here. Because the crabs eat them up and the Polynesian rats chew them up. I mean, that's what rodents do. Even if you found bones after all this time in that environment, you're not going to get sequenceable DNA from it. We went down that road with DNA experts in, God, 2010. We'd already been over that ground. So now, what National Geographic did do, they didn't want to come up with, well, nobody found anything.
Yeah.
They ended the show with this bit about a fragmented skull that they had found in Tarawa. And they thought that this might be the skull that was found in 1940. I had seen that skull when I was in Tarawa in
Yeah.
2001
Yeah.
and looked at it and said, oh, I mean, that's not right. Because it clearly part of a skeleton that had been used for anatomy classes and things had been added. They brought the skull back and they reassembled it for the TV show. Richard Jantz, the University of Tennessee, and I were looking at that. And Richard says, well, I don't see a female skull. I don't know what that is because the thing you look for on a skull to tell gender is the glabella, the area between the eyebrows,
Yeah.
above the bridge of the nose. That's different in men and women, very reliable. And on this skull, whatever that once was, has been built up with like plaster of Paris or something. What's there is not real.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And I see other things about this skull that are markers for Polynesian skulls. So that was their way of salvaging the show.
Yeah.
And it was close to a year later before they finally said, no, turns out that skull is not
Yeah.
there. But it was a great documentary.
It was.
Values were beautiful, and I had almost as much screen time in that show as Bob did.
It was great to see people like Candace Fleming in the show and people that
Oh,
hadn't
yeah.
had spotlight shown
No.
on them in a long time to join you guys in the show and talk about the legacy. And that was really great.
I worked with Candy when she was working on her book, and it's an excellent
It's
book.
an excellent book.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
You know, I want to ask you a question. This could potentially be a really fun question.
All right.
It's always been interesting to me that a case like this has so many camps. We've talked a little bit about Japanese capture, Crash and Sink, we know Castaway, there's several others. Everyone obviously feels as strongly and passionately about their ideas and theories. It can get kind of rough sometimes between folks. I've talked to, we mentioned it earlier, a lot of people on the show, a lot of Tiger representation. We're well over 100 episodes now, and most of the time, it feels like this 5 or 6 way debate over what happened to Earhart and Noonan. We know that better than anybody. We did this through Vanished. We've been through this process. But one of the other trends that I've noticed in doing this show for 7 years is this trend of Tiger versus everyone. Like, people love to take shots at what the organization's done. They love to scrutinize and place everything you guys do under a microscope. I feel it's only right to give you the floor here to respond to that. Am I way off base here, or is that a fair statement? Do you ever feel like it's Tiger versus everyone?
Yeah, let me think how I want to respond to this.
Take your time.
I've always said I'm very proud of my enemies. I have the right enemies, because the people who vehemently disagree, Tiger can't counter the evidence we've found. The best they can come up with, well, I don't disagree with that. I don't think... Let me give you an example. And sure. He's never been very nasty about it. And I consider him a friend. Tom Crouch at the National Air Space Museum. Tom likes to say, I think what Tiger has proven with all their trips to Nicomoraro is that she wasn't there.
Yeah.
Because if she was, they'd have found something. Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of think we found a hell of a lot. If Tom Crouch has some received wisdom about what must have survived after all these years in that environment from some castaway, I wish he'd tell me how he knows that. But it's a way of dismissing without providing any evidence. Yeah, there's no closed circuit TV at the castaway campsite. So we don't know everything that has ever happened there. We've researched it as best we can. And we can't explain the stuff we've found there that seems consistent with Earhart.
Yeah.
But it's also the case that all artifactual evidence is circumstantial by definition. Unless you find something with somebody's name on it.
Right.
Or a serial number or something like that, what you're left with is a probability. Well, okay, so we've got this zipper pull that we know is an American zipper pull that was manufactured between 1933 and 1936 because of the stuff that's on it and not on it. We've identified all that. The military never used this. It's American. There's no reason to think that any Gilbertese or British person on the island would have something like this. And it's entirely consistent with Earhart. But we can't say that this is Earhart's zipper pull.
Right, right.
It's circumstantial. The stuff that's not circumstantial is the archival evidence, the photographic evidence, the electromagnetic evidence, the post-loss radio signals, the anthropological evidence that Jens came up with. You know, smoking guns come in many calibers, and we've got a bunch of them. What we don't have is physical evidence. We don't have the airplane.
Yeah.
We've got a couple of artifacts we found on the island, especially this thing that I really suspect is a heat shield that was designed to protect the tanks from the heater duct, but I can't prove it.
Yeah.
There's no part number on it, which says that it's not World War II, and it is an airplane part. But still, you know, that kind of thing is very frustrating.
Yeah.
But it doesn't outweigh the fact that we don't have physical evidence. Mm-hmm. It doesn't outweigh the evidence we do have. People talk about proof.
Yeah.
And as you've read in the preface of the book, I say, well, none of the books that have been written have come up with proof about what happened to Earhart. And neither has mine, because proof doesn't exist except in mathematics and symbolic logic.
Yeah.
Any mystery always comes down to probability. And when the probability of a certain answer to a mystery becomes strong enough, we as a culture accept it as proof. It's not really. Any hypothesis is subject to later being disproved.
Sure.
Now, you can disprove a hypothesis, easy, but proving it, never going to do it. Earlier tonight, we talked about the possibility that somebody took pictures of airplane parts on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we found those and they were clearly identified as some other kind of airplane than a Lockheed Electra.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell of that. But yeah, if it happened, you'd have to stop and say, wait a minute, some other airplane crashed at this island? Whose airplane was it? What kind of airplane was it? It's certainly possible that, well, I don't know. It's possible, but I don't know quite how it would happen, that a plane would crash there and nobody knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because before World War II, there were no airplanes in that part of the world. Earhart's was the first. And before World War II, there were already people on the island.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that would happen. But if it did happen, everything we found can be disproven if our evidence can be shown to be unreliable
mm-hmm.
or just wrong.
How would you feel personally if that happened? Theoretically, let's talk about it since you're bringing it up. I think it's a rare question to ask you. I mean, how would you feel personally if something happened like that?
I flatter myself in thinking of myself as a scientist, mm-hmm. as an aircraft accident investigator. I'm not interested in a particular result. I'm mm-hmm. interested in truth. That's what counts. How would I have felt if Tony Romeo came back and said, here it is?
It's a good question.
We set a camera down there. You can read it yourself. NR16020.
Mm-hmm.
And I have acknowledged in my mind
mm-hmm.
that possibility. How would I react to that?
Yeah.
The best I can come up with is that, well, at least now we know what really happened. But mm-hmm. now I'm really curious about what happened. Well, we didn't make all this stuff up, you know.
Right.
Something happened to that island that is only explainable. You know, what about the post-loss radio signals if she crashed at sea? Who the hell was on Gardner Island mimicking mm-hmm. Earhart's voice on her frequency mm-hmm. and knew she was going to disappear so they could be there the evening as she disappeared? Now, how is that possible? That's where my head would be. You do the best you can and reach your conclusions
yeah.
and accept that you could be wrong. But if I'm wrong, show me where I'm wrong. Don't just tell me, yeah, well, I don't think so. No, it's not good enough. I have shown the world, if you will, what Tiger has found. We have made our case.
Mm-hmm.
And our case leads to a conclusion that I have laid out in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong, show us where we're wrong.
Yeah.
Do the same work we did.
Mm-hmm.
Check our work. Show us where we made a mistake. Show us where we made an unwarranted assumption. That's where I am on that.
Yeah. Well, very well said. And you know, this is the elephant in the room. I think if I didn't ask you this next question, I think I would be crucified by my audience. So I'm going to ask it, and we're going to see how this goes. You are an accident investigator at your core, at your soul, at your heart. That's where you started. That's where you live. That's what you do. You know that we're mounting this expedition out to Buka. You and Bill both just want to know an answer to whatever that respective story is that they're investigating. This wreck site out of Buka, you know, who am I? But it has me and an awful lot of other people and organizations intrigued now. Here's the number one question that listeners wanted me to ask you. If you got a call from Bill Snavely, or anyone else for that matter, that's investigating any other theory, and they really wanted you to take a part of an expedition, or look at something, or give your opinion, as an aircraft accident investigator, do you sit on that for a bit and think about it, or are those just automatic declines as far as you're concerned?
No, they're automatic yeses. God, I get at least once every 2 weeks.
I'm sure you do.
Every 2 weeks, I get an email from somebody who has found a Amelia Earhart's airplane on Google Earth.
Right.
Okay. Right. And or I get an email from somebody in PNG and
Papua New Guinea. Sure.
Who says, up in back of our village, there's an airplane wreck that is a Amelia Earhart's airplane. And mm-hmm. I said, send me a picture. I would say that to Bill Snavely.
Mm-hmm.
If you think what's there in the water is Earhart's airplane, show me a picture. I don't know, maybe he's got one, but I've never seen it. I've mm-hmm. never seen anything that looks like an airplane at all, let alone a military. Yeah.
Well, it certainly does it now. That nautical environment there, you know, speaking of Nicomororo, which is a ferocious environment in and of itself, that's a horrific nautical environment. We have no grand illusions of dragging this thing up off the floor. It's the fuselage is gone. It's a ghost of an airframe at this point.
If you got nothing, show me why you think I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to it, but
Sure.
what do you have beside what somebody told you they saw? What do you have besides that?
Well, the
Because
DNA is one thing that really kind of
what
shook
DNA?
us. I'm not sure if you know this or not, but during the second expedition, they found what they thought amounted to nothing. They just sort of collected some stuff out of the cockpit area. That data was sent over to Parabon, who is, I consider one of the best DNA labs on the face of the earth. This was all done during COVID. And I got a call one day, about 6, 8 months later. I was on the road. I'll never forget it. And they said, hey, a lot of those samples that you sent us obviously weren't testable, but there were actually a few that were. And one of the pieces of DNA that we tested, it came back to European descent, which happened to match Noonan's lineage.
Okay, I assume you're familiar with mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And then it's passed through the female line. Okay,
Yes.
so to get an example of somebody's mitochondrial DNA, you've got to find somebody, a living person, or you become a dead person, in the female. We actually, literally, to get Noonan mitochondrial DNA, you'd have to dig up his mother.
Right. And that's the
Yeah,
rub.
and
That's the tough
nobody's going
part.
to do that. If you've got DNA from a supposed airplane wreck that is a person of European descent, that's going to be an Australian, any American, any Brit. It's probably not a Japanese,
Probably not.
but I mean, that's what you've got, Chris. That's nothing.
Well, he wants his answer. God bless him
And
for
God
that.
bless
And I,
him. Go for it. Tony
he's,
wanted his answer, and he
and
got it. And if
yeah.
Salem gets out there, he'll get his answer too.
And I think that's something that everybody has in common here. I mean, everybody wants their answer. They want to see it through to the end. You touched on it tonight. We'll end this conversation tonight with a question I've asked several times in the show. You praised Tony Romeo's willingness to come out and admit, hey, we were wrong. It's a strikeout. We're going to keep going, but we were wrong.
If somebody shows us that we're wrong, I will do the same thing. I just
Yeah.
haven't seen it yet.
Well, and here's the thing, and I know how you feel in your heart of hearts about this. You've certainly expressed that tonight. And we've talked about this case being solved definitively and smoking guns and a lot of that stuff tonight. But let's theoretically say, in a general sense, we never find out what happened that day. You mentioned it earlier. If all we're left with is more questions, more hypotheses, more stories, are you personally okay with the public just not having definitiveness in their opinion? Because I imagine if Castaway is proven to be the end game, we've talked about a lot in the last couple questions about it. Hey, what if you're wrong? Well, if Castaway is proven to be the end game, there would be an immense, I imagine, amount of vindication for you.
I feel tremendously vindicated from what we found. But to answer your question, there's a considerable segment of the population, maybe most people, that would rather have the mystery.
Oh, yeah,
The
sure.
answer's fun. And there is, as you know as well as anybody, there is an entire industry that has grown up around Amelia Earhart, the Amelia Earhart mystery. What's the name of your podcast?
Chasing Earhart.
Yeah,
Yeah, people
yeah.
are either, the way we named it is people are either chasing the legacy or they're chasing the disappearance.
Yeah.
Everyone's chasing Earhart in some way,
Well,
shape, or form.
you can't have her getting caught, or you don't have a. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not laboring under any illusion that this book is going to somehow cause everyone to throw up their hands and say, well, that's the answer to that one.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, it is. And
Yeah.
I don't need for the whole world to do it. I just need for, as Richard Jantz says, I just need people who are capable of processing evidence to do it.
Yeah. Look, that's a hell of a way to end it. The book is One More Good Flight, The Amelia Earhart Tragedy.
Go buy it and
Obviously.
read it, folks.
Go buy it and read it. We'll link it in the show's notes. You and I, obviously we haven't always seen eye to eye, but I've always had a lot of respect for you. I know you didn't have to come back on the show 6 years later, but you did. I truly appreciate that. And I can tell you right now, they're going to be excited to listen to this one. It's a good update. I appreciate you, Rick. Thank you.
And thank you for having me on, Chris. I do appreciate it.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.